had a hole in the back of his hauberk. And when Edmund pressed him back, nearer and nearer to the wall, he jumped up on a mounting block and stood there, raining down blows on Edmund from above. But then, finding that his position, by raising him above the heads of everyone else, made him a mark for every arrow from the Narnian bows, he decided to jump down again. And he meant to look and sound, no doubt for a moment he did look and sound, very grand and very dreadful as he jumped, crying, "The bolt of Tesh falls from above!" But he had to jump sideways, because the crowd in front of him left him no landing place in that direction. And then, in the neatest way you could wish, the tear in the back of his hauberk caught on a hook in the wall. Ages ago this hook had had a ring in it for tying horses to. And there he found himself, like a piece of washing hung up to dry, with everyone laughing at him.
"Let me down, Edmund," howled Rabadash. "Let me down and fight me like a king and a man. Or if you are too great a coward to do that, kill me at once."
"Certainly," began King Edmund, but King Loon interrupted.
"By your Majesty's good leave," said King Loon to Edmund, "not so."
Then turning to Rabadash, he said,
"Your Royal Highness, if you had given that challenge a week ago, I'll answer for it there was no one in King Edmund's dominion, from the High King down to the smallest talking mouse, who would have refused it. But by attacking our castle of Anvard in time of peace without defiance sent, you have proved yourself no knight, but a traitor, and one rather to be whipped by the hangman than to be suffered to cross swords with any person of honour. Take him down, bind him, and carry him within till our pleasure is further known."
Strong hands wrenched Rabadash's sword from him, and he was carried away into the castle, shouting, threatening, cursing, and even crying. For though he could have faced torture, he couldn't bear being made ridiculous. In Tashban, everyone had always taken him seriously. At that moment, Corin ran up to Shasta, seized his hand, and started dragging him toward King Loon.
"Here he is, father! Here he is!" cried Corin.
"Aye, and here thou art at last," said the king in a very gruff voice, "and hast been in the battle, clean contrary to your obedience, a boy to break our father's heart. At your age a rod to your breech were fitter than a sword in your fist, ha?"
But everyone, including Corin, could see that the king was very proud of him.
"Chide him no more, sire, if it please you," said Lord Darin. "His Highness would not be your son if he did not inherit your conditions. It would grieve your Majesty more if he had to be reproved for the opposite fault."
"Well, well," grumbled the king, "we'll pass it over for this time. And now..."
What came next surprised Shasta as much as anything that had ever happened to him in his life. He found himself suddenly embraced in a bear-like hug by King Loon, and kissed on both cheeks. Then the king set him down again and said,
"Stand here together, boys, and let all the court see you. Hold up your heads. Now, gentlemen, look on them both. Has any man any doubts?"
And still Shasta could not understand why everyone stared at him and at Corin, nor what all the cheering was about. Chapter 14. How Bree Became a Wiser Horse. We must now return to Aravis and the horses. The hermit, watching his pool, was able to tell them that Shasta was not killed or even seriously wounded, for he saw him get up and saw how affectionately he was greeted by King Loon. But as he could only see, not hear, he did not know what anyone was saying, and once the fighting had stopped and the talking had begun, it was not worthwhile looking in the pool any longer. Next morning, while the hermit was indoors, the three of them discussed what they should do next.
"I've had enough of this," said Hwin. "The hermit has been very good to us, and I'm very much obliged to him, I'm sure. But I'm getting as fat as a pet pony, eating all day and getting no exercise. Let's go on to Narnia."
"Oh, not today, ma'am," said Bree. "I wouldn't hurry things. Some other day, don't you think?"
"We must see Shasta first and say good-bye to him, and apologize," said Aravis.
"Exactly," said Bree, with great enthusiasm. "Just what I was going to say."
"Oh, of course," said Hwin. "I expect he is in Anvard. Naturally we'd look in on him and say good-bye. But that's on our way. And why shouldn't we start at once? After all, I thought it was Narnia we all wanted to get to."
"I suppose so,"
said Aravis. She was beginning to wonder what exactly she would do when she got there, and was feeling a little lonely.
Of course, said Bree hastily. But there's no need to rush things, if you know what I mean.
No, I don't know what you mean, said Wynne. Why don't you want to go?
Muttered Bree. Well, don't you see, ma'am? It's an important occasion. Returning to one's country, entering society, the best society. It is so essential to make a good impression. Not perhaps looking quite ourselves yet, eh?
Wynne broke out into a hoarse laugh.
It's your tail, Bree. I see it all now. You want to wait till your tail's grown again. And we don't even know if tails are worn long in Narnia. Really, Bree, you're as vain as that Tarquina in Tashban. You are silly, Bree, said Aravis.
By the lion's mane, Tarquina, I'm nothing of the sort, said Bree indignantly. I have a proper respect for myself and for my fellow horses, that's all.
Bree,
said Aravis, who was not very interested in the cut of his tail.
I've been wanting to ask you something for a long time. Why do you keep on swearing by the lion and by the lion's mane? I thought you hated lions.
So I do, answered Bree. But when I speak of the lion, of course I mean Aslan, the great deliverer of Narnia who drove away the witch in the winter. All Narnians swear by him.
But is he a lion?
No, of course not, said Bree in a rather shocked voice.
All the stories about him in Tashban say he is, replied Aravis. And if he isn't a lion, why do you call him a lion?
Well, you'd hardly understand that at your age, said Bree. And I was only a little foal when I left, so I don't quite fully understand it myself.
Bree was standing with his back to the green wall while he said this, and the other two were facing him. He was talking in rather a superior tone, with his eyes half shut. That was why he didn't see the changed expression in the faces of Wynne and Aravis. They had good reason to have open mouths and staring eyes, because while Bree spoke, they saw an enormous lion leap up from outside and balance itself on the top of the green wall. Only it was a brighter yellow, and it was bigger and more beautiful and more alarming than any lion they had ever seen. And at once it jumped down inside the wall and began approaching Bree from behind. It made no noise at all, and Wynne and Aravis couldn't make any noise themselves, no more than if they were frozen.
No doubt, continued Bree, when they speak of him as a lion, they only mean he's as strong as a lion, or, to our enemies, of course, as fierce as a lion, or something of that kind. Even a little girl like you, Aravis, must see it would be quite absurd to suppose he is a real lion. Indeed, it would be disrespectful. If he was a lion, he'd have to be a beast, just like the rest of us. Why?
And here Bree began to laugh.
If he was a lion, he'd have four paws and a tail and whiskers. Help!
For just as he said the word whiskers, one of Aslan's had actually tickled his ear. Bree shot away like an arrow to the other side of the enclosure and there turned. The wall was too high for him to jump, and he could fly no further. Aravis and Wynne both started back. There was about a second of intense silence. Then Wynne, shaking all over, gave a strange little neigh and trotted across to the lion.
Please, she said, you're so beautiful. You may eat me if you like. I'd sooner be eaten by you than fed by anyone else.
Dearest daughter,
said Aslan, planting a lion's kiss on her twitching velvet nose,
I knew you would not be long in coming to me. Joy shall be yours.
Then he lifted his head and spoke in a louder voice.
Now, Bree, he said, you poor, proud, frightened horse. Draw near. Nearer still, my son. Do not dare not to dare. Touch me. Smell me. Here are my paws, here is my tail, these are my whiskers. I am a true beast.
Aslan, said Bree in a shaken voice, I'm afraid I must be rather a fool.
Happy the horse who knows that while he is still young. Or the human either. Draw near, Aravis, my daughter. See? My paws are velveted. You will not be torn this time.
"'This time, sir,'
said Aravis. "'It was I who wounded you. "'I am the only lion you met in all your journeyings. "'Do you know why I tore you?'
"'No, sir.'
"'The scratches on your back. "'Tear for tear. "'Throb for throb. "'Blood for blood. "'Were equal to the stripes laid on the back of your stepmother's slave "'because of the drugged sleep you cast upon her.' You needed to know what it felt like.
Yes, sir. Please.
Ask on, my dear, said Aslan.
Will any more harm come to her by what I did?
Child, said the lion, I am telling you your story, not hers. No one is told any story but their own. Then he shook his head and spoke in a lighter voice. Be merry, little ones, he said. We shall meet again soon. But before that, you will have another visitor. Then in one bound he reached the top of the wall and vanished from their sight. Strange to say, they felt no inclination to talk to one another about him after he had gone. They all moved slowly away to different parts of the quiet grass, and there paced to and fro, each alone, thinking. About half an hour later, the two horses were summoned to the back of the house to eat something nice that the hermit had got ready for them. And Aravis, still walking and thinking, was startled by the harsh sound of a trumpet outside the gate.
"'Who is there?'
asked Aravis.
"'His Royal Highness Prince Kor of Arkenland,' said a voice from outside.
Aravis undid the door and opened it, drawing back a little way to let the strangers in. Two soldiers with halberds came first and took their stand at each side of the entry. Then followed a herald and the trumpeter.
"'His Royal Highness Prince Kor of Arkenland desires an audience of the Lady Aravis,' said the herald.
Then he and the trumpeter drew aside and bowed, and the soldiers saluted, and the prince himself came in. All his attendants withdrew and closed the gate behind them. The prince bowed, and a very clumsy bow for a prince it was. Aravis curtsied in the Colomine style, which is not at all like ours, and did it very well because, of course, she had been taught how. Then she looked up, and saw what sort of person this prince was. She saw a mere boy. He was bareheaded, and his fair hair was encircled with a very thin band of gold, hardly thicker than a wire. His upper tunic was of white cambric, as fine as a handkerchief, so that the bright red tunic beneath it showed through. His left hand, which rested on his enamelled sword-hilt, was bandaged. Aravis looked twice at his face before she gasped, and said,
"'Why, it's Shasta!'
Shasta, all at once, turned very red and began speaking very quickly.
"'Look here, Aravis,' he said. "'I do hope you won't think I'm got up like this and the trumpeter in order to try to impress you or make out that I'm different or any rot of that sort, because I'd far rather have come in my old clothes, but they're burnt now, and my father said—'
"'Your father?'
said Aravis.
"'Apparently King Loon is my father,' said Shasta. "'I might really have guessed it, Corin being so like me. We were twins, you see. Oh, my name isn't Shasta. It's Kor.'
"'Kord is a nicer name than Shasta,'
said Aravis.
"'Brothers' names run like that in Arkenland,'
said Shasta, or Prince Kor, as we must now call him,
like Dar and Darin, Cole and Colin, and so on.
"'Shasta, I mean Kor,' said Aravis. "'No, shut up. There's something I've got to say at once. I'm sorry I've been such a pig. But I did change before I knew you were a prince. Honestly, I did.' When you went back and faced the lion.
It wasn't really going to kill you at all, that lion, said Kor.
I know, said Aravis, nodding.
Both were still and solemn for a moment, as each saw that the other knew about Aslan. Suddenly Aravis remembered Kor's bandaged hand.
I say, she cried, I forgot. You've been in a battle. Is that a wound?
A mere scratch,
said Kor, using for the first time a rather lordly tone. But a moment later he burst out laughing and said,
"'If you want to know the truth, it isn't a proper wound at all. I only took the skin off my knuckles, just as any clumsy fool might do without going near a battle.'
"'Still, you were in the battle,' said Aravis. "'It must have been wonderful.'
"'It wasn't at all like what I thought,' said Kor.
"'But Kor, I mean, you haven't told me—' "'anything yet about King Loon and how he found out who you were?'
"'Well, let's sit down,' said Kor, "'for it's rather a long story.'
And by the way, Father's an absolute brick. I'd be just as pleased, or very nearly, at finding he's my father, even if he weren't a king. Even though education and all sorts of horrible things are going to happen to me. But you want the story? Well, Corin and I are twins. And about a week after we were both born, apparently, they took us to a wise old centaur in Narnia to be blessed or something. Now, this centaur was a prophet, as a good many centaurs are. Perhaps you haven't seen any centaurs yet. There were some in the battle yesterday. Most remarkable people. But I can't say I feel quite at home with them yet. I say, Atavis, there are going to be a lot of things to get used to in these northern countries.
Yes, there are, said Atavis.
But get on with the story.
Well, as soon as he saw Corin and me, it seems this centaur looked at me and said, a day will come when that boy will save Arkenland from the deadliest danger in which ever she lay. So, of course, my father and mother were very pleased. But there was someone present who wasn't. This was a chap called Lord Barr, who had been Father's Lord Chancellor. And apparently he'd done something wrong. Bezzling, or some word like that. I didn't understand that part very well. And Father had had to dismiss him. But nothing else was done to him, and he was allowed to go on living in Arkenland. But he must have been as bad as he could be, for it came out afterward he had been in the pay of the Tisrock, and had sent a lot of secret information to Tashban. So as soon as he heard I was going to save Arkenland from a great danger, he decided I must be put out of the way. Well, he succeeded in kidnapping me, I don't exactly know how, and rode away down the winding Arrow to the coast. He'd had everything prepared, and there was a ship manned with his own followers, lying ready for him, and he put out to sea with me on board. But Father got wind of it, though not quite in time, and was after him as quickly as he could. The Lord Bar was already at sea when Father reached the coast, but not out of sight, and Father was embarked in one of his own warships within 20 minutes. It must have been a wonderful chase. They were 6 days following Bar's galleon, and brought her to battle on the 7th. It was a great sea fight. I heard a lot about it yesterday evening, from 10 o'clock in the morning till sunset. Our people took the ship in the end, but I wasn't there. The Lord Bar himself had been killed in the battle. But one of his men said that early that morning, as soon as he saw he was certain to be overhauled, Bar had given me to one of his knights, and sent us both away in the ship's boat. And that boat was never seen again. But of course that was the same boat that Aslan. He seems to be at the back of all the stories, pushed ashore at the right place for Arshish to pick me up. I wish I knew that knight's name, for he must have kept me alive and starved himself to do it. I suppose Aslan would say that was part of someone else's story, said Atavis. I was forgetting that, said Kor.
And I wonder how the prophecy will work out, said Atavis, and what the great danger is that you're to save Arkenland from.
Well, said Kor rather awkwardly, they seem to think I've done it already.
Atavis clapped her hands. Why, of course, she said, how stupid I am, and how wonderful. Arkenland can never be in much greater danger than it was when Rabadash had crossed the Arrow with his 200 horse, and you hadn't yet got through with your message. Don't you feel proud? I think I feel a bit scared, said Kor. And you'll be living in Anvard now, said Atavis, rather wistfully. Oh, said Kor, I'd nearly forgotten what I came about. Father wants you to come and live with us. He says there's been no lady in the court, they call it the court, I don't know why, since Mother died. Do, Atavis. You're like Father. And Corin. They're not like me. They've been properly brought up. You needn't be afraid that... Oh, stop it, said Atavis, or we'll have a real fight. Of course I'll come. Now, let's go and see the horses, said Kor.
There was a great and joyous meeting between Bree and Kor, and Bree, who was still in a rather subdued frame of mind, agreed to set out for Anvard at once. He and Hwin would cross into Narnia on the following day. All four bade an affectionate farewell to the hermit, and promised that they would visit him again soon. By about the middle of the morning they were on their way. The horses had expected that Atavis and Kor would ride, but Kor explained that except in war, where everyone must do what he can do best, no one in Narnia or Arkenland ever dreamed of mounting a talking horse. This reminded poor Bree again of how little he knew about Narnian customs, and what dreadful mistakes he might make. So while Hwin strolled along in a happy dream, Bree got more nervous and more self-conscious with every step he took.
"Buck up, Bree," said Kor. "It's far worse for me than for you. You aren't going to be educated. I should be learning reading and writing and heraldry and dancing and history and music, while you'll be galloping and rolling on the hills of Narnia to your heart's content.
But that's just the point, groaned Bree. Do talking horses roll? Supposing they don't. I can't bear to give it up. What do you think, Huynh?
I'm going to roll anyway, said Huynh. I don't suppose any of them will care two lumps of sugar whether you roll or not.
Are we near that castle? Said Bree to Cor.
Round the next bend, said the prince.
Well, said Bree, I'm going to have a good one now. It may be the last. Wait for me a minute. It was 5 minutes before he rose again, blowing hard and covered with bits of bracken. Now I'm ready, he said in a voice of profound gloom. Lead on, Prince Cor. Narnia and the North. But he looked more like a horse going to a funeral than a long-lost captive returning to home and freedom.
Chapter 15. Rabadash the Ridiculous. The next turn of the road brought them out from among the trees, and there, across green lawns, sheltered from the north wind by the high wooded ridge at its back, they saw the castle of Anvard. It was very old and built of a warm, reddish-brown stone. Before they had reached the gate, King Lune came out to meet them, not looking at all like Aravis's idea of a king, and wearing the oldest of old clothes. For he had just come from making a round of the kennels with his huntsmen, and had only stopped for a moment to wash his doggy hands. But the bow with which he greeted Aravis as he took her hand would have been stately enough for an emperor.
"Little lady," he said, "we bid you very heartily welcome. My dear wife was still alive. We could make you better cheer, but could not do it with a better will. And I am sorry that you have had misfortunes and been driven from your father's house, which cannot but be a grief to you. My son, Cor, has told me about your adventures together and all your valour."
"It was he who did all that, sir," said Aravis. "Why, he rushed at a lion to save me."
"Hey, what's that?" said King Lune, his face brightening. "I haven't heard that part of the story."
Then Aravis told it, and Cor, who had very much wanted the story to be known, though he felt he couldn't tell it himself, didn't enjoy it so much as he had expected, and indeed felt rather foolish. But his father enjoyed it very much indeed, and in the course of the next few weeks told it to so many people that Cor wished it had never happened. Then the king turned to Huynh and Bree, and was just as polite to them as to Aravis, and asked them a lot of questions about their families and where they had lived in Narnia before they had been captured. The horses were rather tongue-tied, for they weren't yet used to being talked to as equals by humans. Grown-up humans, that is. They didn't mind Aravis and Cor. Presently Queen Lucy came out from the castle and joined them, and King Lune said to Aravis,
"My dear, here is a loving friend of our house, and she has been seeing that your apartments are put to rights for you better than I could have done it."
"You'd like to come and see them, wouldn't you?" said Lucy, kissing Aravis.
They liked each other at once, and soon went away together to talk about Aravis's bedroom and Aravis's boudoir, and about getting clothes for her, and all the sort of things girls do talk about on such an occasion. After lunch, which they had on the terrace, it was cold birds and cold game pie and wine and bread and cheese, King Lune ruffled up his brow and heaved a sigh and said,
"Hey-ho, we have still that sorry creature Rabadash on our hands, my friends, and must needs resolve what to do with him."
Lucy was sitting on the king's right and Aravis on the left. King Edmund sat at one end of the table and the Lord Darin faced him at the other. Dar and Peridan and Cor and Corin were on the same side as the king.
"Your Majesty would have a perfect right to strike off his head," said Peridan. "Such an assault as he made puts him on a level with assassins."
"It is very true," said Edmund. "But even a traitor may mend. I have known one that did." And he looked very thoughtful.
"To kill this Rabadash would go near to raising war with the Tisroch," said Darin.
"A fig for the Tisroch," said King Lune. "His strength is in numbers, and numbers will never cross the desert. But I have no stomach for killing men, even traitors in cold blood. To have cut his throat in the battle would have eased my heart mightily, but this is a different thing."
"By my counsel," said Lucy, "your Majesty will give him another trial. Let him go free on straight promise of fair dealing in the future.
it may be that he will keep his word. Maybe apes will grow honest, sister, said Edmund. But by the lion, if he breaks it again, may it be in such time and place that any of us could swap off his head in clean battle.
It shall be tried, said the king.
And then to one of the attendants,
send for the prisoner, friend.
Rabadash was brought before them, in chains. To look at him, anyone would have supposed that he had passed the night in a noisome dungeon without food or water, but in reality he had been shut up in quite a comfortable room and provided with an excellent supper. But as he was sulking far too furiously to touch the supper, and had spent the whole night stamping and roaring and cursing, he naturally did not now look his best.
"Your Royal Highness needs not to be told," said King Loon, "that by the Lord of Nations, as well as by all reasons of prudent policy, we have as good right to your head as ever one mortal man had against another. Nevertheless, in consideration of your youth and the ill nurture, devoid of all gentlesse and courtesy, which you have doubtless had in the land of slaves and tyrants, we are disposed to set you free, unharmed, on these conditions. First, that—"
"Curse you for a barbarian dog," spluttered Rabadash. "Do you think I will even hear your conditions? Ha! You talk very largely of nurture, and I know not what. It's easy to a man in chains, ha! Take off these vile bonds, give me a sword, and let any of you who dares then debate with me."
Nearly all the lords sprang to their feet, and Corin shouted,
"Father, can I box him, please?"
"Peace, your majesties, my lords," said King Loon. "Have we no more gravity among us than to be so chafed by the taunt of a pajock? Sit down, Corin, or shalt leave the table. I ask your highness again to hear our conditions."
"I hear no conditions from barbarians and sorcerers," said Rabadash. "Not one of you dare touch a hair of my head. Every insult you have heaped on me shall be paid with oceans of Narnian and Arkanlandish blood. Terrible shall the vengeance of the Tizrok be, even now. But kill me, and the burnings and torturings in these northern lands shall become a tale to frighten the world a thousand years hence. Beware, 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 the bolt of Tash falls from above."
"Does it ever get caught on a hook halfway?" asked Corin.
"Shame, Corin," said the king. "Never taunt a man save when he is stronger than you. Then as you please."
"Oh, you foolish Rabadash," sighed Lucy.
Next moment, Cor wondered why everyone at the table had risen and was standing perfectly still. Of course, he did the same himself. And then he saw the reason. Aslan was among them, though no one had seen him coming. Rabadash started as the immense shape of the lion paced softly in between him and his accusers.
"Rabadash," said Aslan, "take heed. Your doom is very near, but you may still avoid it. Forget your pride. What have you to be proud of? And your anger? Who has done you wrong? And accept the mercy of these good kings."
Then Rabadash rolled his eyes and spread out his mouth into a horrible, long, mirthless grin like a shark, and wagged his ears up and down. Anyone can learn how to do this if they take the trouble. He had always found this very effective in Calormen. The bravest had trembled when he made these faces, and ordinary people had fallen to the floor, and sensitive people had often fainted. But what Rabadash hadn't realized is that it is very easy to frighten people who know you can have them boiled alive the moment you give the word. The grimaces didn't look at all alarming in Arkanland. Indeed, Lucy only thought Rabadash was going to be sick.
"Demon! Demon! Demon!" shrieked the prince. "I know you. You are the foul fiend of Narnia. You are the enemy of the gods. Learn who I am, horrible phantasm. I am descended from Tash, the inexorable, the irresistible. The curse of Tash is upon you. Lightning in the shape of scorpions shall be rained on you. The mountains of Narnia shall be ground into dust. The—"
"Have a care, Rabadash," said Aslan quietly. "The doom is nearer now. It is at the door. It has lifted the latch."
"Let the skies fall!" shrieked Rabadash. "Let the earth gape! Let blood and fire obliterate the world!
But be sure I will never desist till I have dragged to my palace by her hair the barbarian queen, the daughter of dogs, the...
The hour has struck, said Aslan, and Rabadash saw to his supreme horror that everyone had begun to laugh. They couldn't help it. Rabadash had been wagging his ears all the time, and as soon as Aslan said, the hour has struck, the ears began to change. They grew longer and more pointed, and soon were covered with grey hair. And while everyone was wondering where they had seen ears like that before, Rabadash's face began to change too. It grew longer, and thicker at the top, and larger-eyed, and the nose sank back into the face, or else the face swelled out and became all nose, and there was hair all over it. And his arms grew longer and came down in front of him, till his hands were resting on the ground. Only they weren't hands now. They were hoofs. And he was standing on all fours, and his clothes disappeared, and everyone laughed louder and louder, because they couldn't help it. For now what had been Rabadash was simply and unmistakably a donkey. The terrible thing was that his human speech lasted just a moment longer than his human shape, so that when he realized the change that was coming over him, he screamed out,
"Oh, not a donkey! Mercy, if it were even a horse! In a hoy, e-aw!"
And so the words died away into a donkey's bray.
"Now hear me, Rabadash," said Aslan. "Justice shall be mixed with mercy. You shall not always be an ass."
At this, of course, the donkey twitched its ears forward, and that also was so funny that everybody laughed all the more. They tried not to, but they tried in vain.
"You have appealed to Tash," said Aslan, "and in the temple of Tash you shall be healed. You must stand before the altar of Tash in Tashban at the great autumn feast this year, and there, in the sight of all Tashban, your ass's shape will fall from you, and all men will know you for Prince Rabadash. But as long as you live, if ever you go more than 10 miles away from the great temple in Tashban, you shall instantly become again as you now are. And from that second change there will be no return."
There was a short silence, and then they all stirred and looked at one another, as if they were waking from sleep. Aslan was gone, but there was a brightness in the air and on the grass, and a joy in their hearts which assured them that he had been no dream. And anyway, there was the donkey in front of them. King Loon was the kindest-hearted of men, and on seeing his enemy in this regrettable condition, he forgot all his anger.
"Your Royal Highness," he said, "I am most truly sorry that things have come to this extremity. Your Highness will bear witness that it was none of our doing. And of course we should be delighted to provide Your Highness with shipping back to Tashban for the, treatment which Aslan has prescribed. You shall have every comfort which Your Highness's situation allows. The best of the cattle boats, the freshest carrots and thistles."
But a deafening bray from the donkey and a well-aimed kick at one of the guards made it clear that these kindly offers were ungratefully received. And here, to get him out of the way, I'd better finish off the story of Rabadash. He, or it, was duly sent back by boat to Tashban, and brought into the temple of Tash at the great autumn festival, and then he became a man again. But of course 4,000 or 5,000 people had seen the transformation, and the affair could not possibly be hushed up. And after the old Tizrok's death, when Rabadash became Tizrok in his place, he turned out the most peaceable Tizrok Kalorman had ever known. This was because, not daring to go more than 10 miles from Tashban, he could never go on a war himself, and he didn't want his Tarkans to win fame in the wars at his expense, for that is the way Tizroks get overthrown. But though his reasons were selfish, it made things much more comfortable for all the smaller countries round Kalorman. His own people never forgot that he had been a donkey. During his reign, and to his face, he was called Rabadash the Peacemaker. But after his death, and behind his back, he was called Rabadash the Ridiculous. And if you look him up in a good history of Kalorman, try the local library, you will find him under that name. And to this day, in Kalormin schools, if you do anything unusually stupid, you are very likely to be called
a second Rabadash. Meanwhile, at Anvard, everyone was very glad that he had been disposed of before the real fun began, which was a grand feast held that evening on the lawn before the castle, with dozens of lanterns to help the moonlight. And the wine flowed, and tales were told, and jokes were cracked. And then silence was made, and the king's poet with two fiddlers stepped out into the middle of the circle. Arvis and Cor propelled themselves to be bored, for the only poetry they knew was the Calormine kind, and you know now what that was like. But at the very first scrape of the fiddles, a rocket seemed to go up inside their heads, and the poet sang the great old lay of Fair Olwyn, and how he fought the giant Pyre, and turned him into stone. And that is the origin of Mount Pyre. It was a two-headed giant, and won the Lady Lilne for his bride. And when it was over, they wished it was going to begin again. And though Bree couldn't sing, he told the story of the fight at Zalindre. And Lucy told again, they heard all except Arvis and Cor heard it many times, but they all wanted it again, the tale of the wardrobe, and how she and King Edmund and Queen Susan and Peter, the High King, had first come into Narnia. And presently, as was certain to happen sooner or later, King Loon said it was time for young people to be in bed. "And tomorrow, Cor," he added, "shalt come over all the castle with me, and see the estate, and mark all its strength and weakness, for it will be thine to guard when I'm gone."
"But Corin will be the king then, father," said Cor.
"Nay, lad," said King Loon, "thou art my heir. The crown comes to thee."
"But I don't want it," said Cor. "I'd far rather—"
"'Tis no question what thou wantest, Cor, nor I neither. 'Tis in the course of law."
"But if we're twins, we must be the same age."
"Nay," said the king with a laugh, "one must come first. Art Corin's elder by full 20 minutes? And 'tis better too, let's hope, though that's no great mastery." And he looked at Corin with a twinkle in his eyes.
"Father, couldn't you make whichever you like to be the next king?"
"No. The king's under the law, for it's the law makes him a king. Hast no more power to start away from thy crown than any sentry from his post."
"Oh, dear," said Cor, "I don't want to at all. And, Corin, I'm most dreadfully sorry. I never dreamed my turning up was going to chisel you out of your kingdom."
"Hurrah, hurrah," said Corin. "I shan't have to be king. I shan't have to be king. I'll always be a prince. It's princes have all the fun."
"And that's truer than thy brother knows, Cor," said King Loon. "For this is what it means to be a king. To be first in every desperate attack and last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, as must be now and then in bad years, to wear finer clothes and laugh louder over a scantier meal than any man in your land."
When the two boys were going upstairs to bed, Cor again asked Corin if nothing could be done about it, and Corin said,
"If you say another word about it, I'll knock you down."
It would be nice to end the story by saying that after that, the two brothers never disagreed about anything again, but I'm afraid it would not be true. In reality, they quarrelled and fought just about as often as any other two boys would, and all their fights ended, if they didn't begin, with Cor getting knocked down. For though when they had both grown up and become swordsmen, Cor was the more dangerous man in battle, neither he nor anyone else in the North Countries could ever equal Corin as a boxer. That was how he got his name of Corin Thunderfist, and how he performed his great exploit against the lapsed Bear of Storm Ness, which was really a talking bear, but had gone back to wild bear habits. Corin climbed up to its lair on the Narnian side of Storm Ness one winter day when the snow was on the hills, and boxed it without a timekeeper for 33 rounds. And at the end it couldn't see out of its eyes, and became a reformed character. Arvis also had many quarrels, and I'm afraid even fights, with Cor, but they always made it up again. So that years later, when they were grown up, they were so used to quarrelling and making up again, that they got married, so as to go on doing it more conveniently. And after King Loon's death, they made a good king and queen of Arkenland, and Ram the Great, the most famous of all the kings of Arkenland, was their son. Bree and Hwin lived happily to a great age in Narnia, and both got married, but not to one another. And there weren't many months in which one or both of them didn't come trotting over the pass to visit their friends at Anvard.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.